This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and this is our weekly recap show. Carey Jr. II is here. He is our show's producer.
Yeah, I'm here looking forward to kind of recapping these conversations.
We had this incredible conversation this week about the high price of everything, that no matter where you go and what you spend, it seems like it's more than it was before. And that's despite the fact that inflation is technically falling right now. We had a conversation with somebody who says there's a reason for that. It has nothing to do with inflation. It has everything to do with greed. We also talked about AI and facial recognition technology, which is in the news quite a bit these days in the context of police departments and other things. And we were talking about the way in which companies are collecting data, massive amounts of data about Americans from these technologies. But we're going to start with a revisit of a conversation we had about the current presidential contest and what would happen. What would happen in the Democratic Party if Joe Biden, who's the president and the presumptive nominee, were to say, I'm not going to run anymore, and throw it all open? If he does that at the convention, for instance, what's the process that would unfold to pick somebody else?
Yeah, and this is obviously something that came following that first presidential debate. Biden did not have an easy time trying to go back.
That's a really generous description. he was terrible. He had a horrible time. Forget about ideas for just a second. If you can't present your ideas cogently, it's really hard, I think, to get voters to have confidence in you.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, and to that sentiment, right after that debate, a number of Democratic lawmakers called to have him step down and have another candidate who could probably handle those debates a lot better step in and finish out this race. And so that asks us the question, what would that look like if Joe Biden were to do that? How does that process work? How would they go about selecting someone else, especially if it's not the vice president, Kamala Harris?
Yeah.
And so our two guests help us explain that.
Yeah. We talked with Abbas Alawia, who is an uncommitted delegate to the Democratic Convention. He's one of the people who organized the uncommitted campaign here in Michigan in protest of the war on Gaza that Israel is waging. We also had Professor Matt Dalek with us. He is a political historian at George Washington University, somebody who knows an awful lot about the electoral process inside the two parties. So let's take a listen to what they said about this. So I do want to start with just some very basic defining that we need to do about conventions and delegates and this process. And I'm going to start with you, Dr. Dalek. Tell us how we have come to the place where primary elections generally decide who is going to be the nominee for president of the two major parties, and that the conventions themselves are just kind of shows. They're entertainment and they're rallying points, but there isn't real work, the real work that used to have to take place at these conventions. Give us a little bit of a history lesson here.
Yeah. Well, it's great to be on. We've really got to go back to 1968. And some listeners may recall, or they certainly may have read about, the chaos at that year's Democratic National Convention, also eerily enough in Chicago.
In Chicago, yes.
Where, yep, same place. And Hubert Humphrey became the nominee. Lyndon Johnson had stepped down. Basically as the presumptive nominee because of the Vietnam War. And the Democratic Party was fractured over the war, many other issues. And even though Humphrey was sort of the chosen candidate by LBJ, there was a real sense in the party, and I think in the post-civil rights, post-voting rights world, that the process needed to be opened up. It could not just be these vast majority of whom are white men in the proverbial smoke-filled room deciding who the nominee was going to be. And so in keeping, in a sense, with the spirit of the voting rights revolution of the 60s, both parties after 1968 started to open up to make their primaries, because there were primaries before 1968, but to make their primary elections binding, meaning that the voters, so before 68, you know, there were a handful of primaries, there were kind of beauty contests, but the primaries were non-binding. So whoever won those primaries didn't mean they were getting that state's delegates. But after 68, if you won, let's say, the state of Michigan in a primary, those delegates were pledged to you as a candidate. And so it really became the choice of the primary electorate rather than the party bosses. And that, in a nutshell, I think is the system we have today.
Yeah. And it's, I think it's really important to point out that before 68 and sort of into that convention, we shouldn't romanticize what was going on. These were not really open conventions in the way that I think we're imagining you might have one today. As you say, they were kind of rigged, right? I mean, there were power brokers who made these decisions together and left most other people out of it.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair way to put it. I mean, there were some contested conventions in 1912, 1924, where a party would have to go to multiple ballots, sometimes dozens of ballots, to figure out who the nominee was. And those were obviously quite wild and contested. But who were they contested among? Well, the people in the hall, right? And who were the people in the hall? These were the party power brokers, right? The, you know, primarily white men who controlled the levers of power. The parties were much more powerful back then, and that created some big downsides. And so opening up the process to the primary voters and also having delegates, especially in the Democratic Party, that are much more reflective of the demographic composition of the country. I think that those are actually overall quite positive changes, and it democratized the nominating process.
Abbas Alawi, I want to bring you into the conversation here. You're an uncommitted delegate for Michigan for the Democratic Convention. First, tell us what that means. Tell us how you became a delegate. What was the process that chose you to do this? And then tell us what you're thinking as we get closer to Chicago in just a few weeks, and this process and the doubt that I guess has kind of cropped up around what should happen. It's a lot.
It's a lot. It's also my birthday, so this is a very special birthday treat birthday for me to dig into this and to learn from Dr. Dalek, who has much more interesting information than I do. But I'm happy to sort of share how I'm coming to my work as a DNC delegate, as an uncommitted DNC delegate. I spent the last 5 years on Capitol Hill working for Congressman Andy Levin, Congressman Tlaib, Congressman Bush, working very closely with President Biden and his White House to advance his agenda. Soon after I moved back home here to southeastern Michigan this past fall, we noticed, we experienced, you know, post-October, on October 7th, the killing of Israeli civilians by Hamas, and post-October 7th, the mass killing of Palestinians using U.S. taxpayer funds. So it's in that context that I became, that I plugged into a movement, helped lead a movement here in southeastern Michigan that has spread around the country, of getting folks to vote uncommitted, to use the ballot box, or to use the box on our ballot that says uncommitted, as a vote for peace and against war. And so how I became elected a delegate is I went to our Congressional District Democratic Party convention, which was held a couple of months ago now, and was the candidate for the uncommitted delegate seat. And so it's an interesting moment in history that we're experiencing now, because now there are all kinds of questions about whether the president can win, not just because of his Gaza policy, but also because of other issues that have come up following the debate, following the unprecedented attempted assassination that we experienced over the weekend.
Yeah.
And so the question of how do we beat the hate-filled agenda that Donald Trump is putting forth is a really important one that is on the mind of a lot of delegates I'm talking to.
So as a delegate then to the convention, what do you imagine your chance is to make that point and make it matter, right? As you say, you're one of two delegates who are uncommitted, and I want you to explain just a little more about what that means you would do at the convention. Most of the delegates are committed to President Biden.
Right.
You are an uncommitted delegate. I want to draw that distinction. But then tell me why that matters or why it could matter in the process here.
Yeah. So, I mean, the uncommitted movement didn't set out to win delegates to begin with. We just wanted to
Be heard.
We wanted to be heard. We wanted to save lives. In the process of doing our work and organizing, we earned over 30 delegate seats across the country that will be going to the convention to lift up the mandate from voters, what we know is central to the base of the Democratic Party, that most Democratic voters don't want unlimited war. Most Democratic voters want a ceasefire. Most Democratic voters don't want us sending unconditional money to Israel or to any other country to kill at a massive scale children or civilians. And so in this context now, because we earned some uncommitted delegate seats, relative to the seats of our Democratic Party nominee, Joe Biden, there are like 4,000 delegates, right? So 30 delegates is not a lot of delegates to meaningfully influence the official proceedings of the DNC. But what we know is that when we show up, when we engage the media, when we organize at the convention, we're speaking for hundreds of thousands of voters across the country, Democratic voters, for whom Gaza is a top policy issue. And so part of my responsibility, in order to get this delegate seat, I had to pledge that when I go to the convention, my vote will be a vote for uncommitted. I would not be committed to any particular candidate.
Right.
The nearly 4,000 Biden delegates pledged that they would vote for President Biden.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting because President Biden last week was asked, well, what do you think about if your delegates don't support you? And he said, my delegates are free to do whatever they want. Which I don't understand to be correct, actually. Dr. Dalek might have better information.
Let's get Dr. Dalek to talk a little more about how that works. Abbas is an uncommitted delegate, which does not pledge him to anybody. But most of the delegates to the convention are pledged to President Biden. So let's talk about what that means now, given that the president is still the presumptive nominee, and then a little later we'll talk about what would happen if he were to step aside.
Yeah, so fascinating listening to this. I think Abbas is absolutely right. The delegates, and frankly, it sounds like even the uncommitted delegates, they are not free to just show up in Chicago and say, I've changed my mind, or to ignore. They are pledged delegates. And that means that, again, as Abbas was saying so well, that they are bound, they're pledged to represent the voices of the thousands, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of people who went to the polls to vote. Now, in the Democratic Party rules, there is this clause that people have talked about that relates to one's conscience. And so there is a kind of potentially technical loophole by which some delegates pledged to Biden could say, I can't in good conscience vote for someone who I don't think now is up, for another 4 years as president.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to happen. I mean, I don't, these are, these are 4,000 plus delegates reflecting the will of, as President Biden said, 14 million voters. They've taken a pledge. And so, I think the idea that they're free to do what they want is it's absolutely not correct. And the whole, and just to kind of back up a second, the whole premise of these post-1968 reforms in both parties is that the primary electorate is king, right? Mm. King and queen, right? The primary electorate gets to choose who the nominee will be. And so the delegates are really vehicles to ratify that decision. And that's why, in part, these conventions are heavily controlled. right? Heavily vetted, controlled by the presumptive nominee, and why, you know, they are more for messaging and for showing the public, you know, what they stand for as a party, as opposed to, you know, as you were saying at the very beginning of this program, deciding, you know, the substantive matter of, you know, who's going to be the nominee.
Yeah, yeah. That was Abbas Alawia, an uncommitted delegate for Michigan to the Democratic Convention that's taking place later this summer in Chicago. Also, that was Professor Matt Dalek, a political historian at George Washington University, talking about what would happen if President Joe Biden decided to step aside. Okay, coming up, we're going to revisit a conversation that explores how corporations, not inflation, may be behind the high prices that you find everywhere. Welcome back to Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, joined by Carrie Jr. the second, and you're listening to our weekly recap. Okay, inflation is the thing that people are still talking about in this country as we get ready for a presidential election. It's going to be one of the major issues. We had a really interesting conversation this week with someone who says inflation is actually not the problem. It's going down. What's happening is that American corporations have taken advantage of the circumstances that caused inflation in the first place and are just keeping prices high because they make more money off of it.
Yeah, we spoke with Bilal Baydoun. He's the director of policy and research at Groundwork Collaborative. That's a progressive advocacy group that did research into this area and found that the companies are making high profits still, even though peak inflation was a couple years ago when it's gone down. It's not all the way down yet, but it's at a point where we should see some difference in prices, they say. And as you said, he makes the argument that companies decided we're not going to lower our prices and we're going to keep them as high as they were at peak inflation and keep making profit off of everyone else. And that's what we're feeling, not necessarily inflation itself.
Yeah, it's not inflation. He says it's just greed.
It's just greed.
We're going to pick up the conversation at the point where we were talking about how, in order to do this, corporations are using lots of the data that they collect about our spending habits, about our bank accounts, about our preferences, to make sure that they can charge us the maximum we will pay at any given time. Why is stuff so expensive right now? When I go to the grocery store, if I go anywhere that I have to spend money, reach into my back pocket, pull out my wallet, I put it back a lot lighter than I did a couple of years ago. And I'm not the only person. I hear people talking about this, posting about it on social media all the time. Why is it happening?
Thank you, Stephen. Well, it's the right question to ask. It's the question that most Americans think about every day. Affordability, the high cost of living, is at the forefront of most people's minds, certainly through the last couple years, but also, of course, during an election year. You know, we went through an inflationary period during the global pandemic. This was a once-in-a-century disruption, economic and obviously health cataclysm. It disrupted global supply chains, which led to a lot of shortages, which led to a rise in prices. There was also a war in Ukraine that unfolded within the same period that affected global food and energy prices. So basically, all of the global supply chains that our global economy relies on to bring goods to market, to deliver services, were snarled, and it took several years for those supply chains to heal and to get back to normal. Now, here's the interesting thing. During that period, and I'm sure there are some small business owners listening to this program, if you're a small business owner and your costs rise, you might raise the price, right? And you want to pass.
You have to. You got to make up for it.
So you got to make up for it, and you want to protect your profit margins. It's hard to compete out here. You have a lot of competition. That's small business. That is not what big business did during the pandemic. What big business did what the largest corporations did is they used the, you know, what I just described as these disrupted supply chains as air cover. And by the way, the air cover is not my language. That is a direct quote from a CEO, from the head of research of Barclays Bank, who said that inflation provided air cover to raise prices. And so essentially what you have today, when you go to the grocery store, when you shop for clothes, when you fill up gas, everywhere you turn throughout the economy, when you pay rent, what you're seeing is companies have rolled out these very risky pricing strategies that are essentially gouging consumers. And the reason that they rolled out these pricing strategies, which we're happy to get into in this conversation, is because people were desperate. People had little place else to turn. And so when you go to the grocery store in the middle of a pandemic and you see that toilet paper is, you know, however much more than it was, you're going to pay that price. Companies fully understood that. And they decided to go for the home run, and they did. The post-pandemic period was the most profitable period for American business in 70 years. I mean, think about that. In the throes of one of the darkest chapters in this country's history, over a million people died from the pandemic. That was also the most profitable period for corporate America. So if you want to talk about the disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street, right, I don't think any period really demonstrated that more.
So I want to go back to something you were just talking about, the distinction between small businesses and big businesses. You say that if you own a small business and the cost of doing business goes up, you don't have a choice but to pass that on to your customers.
Sure.
Why should it be different for big businesses, or why is it different? How do we know that, for instance, the higher price of doing business, the disrupted supply chains, didn't also force big business to raise its prices?
Sure. Well, again, let's say it really comes down to one factor: competition. Let's say that you're in Metro Detroit and you own a small business. Let's call it, because it's the Motor City, let's call it a tire repair shop.
We don't have any of those.
Yeah, we don't have any of those, right? So think of the sheer volume of tire repair shops. And so if you wanted to pull off something similar, you'd go out of business. If you use the sort of pandemic, the emergency as an opportunity, to hike the prices of tires to an exorbitant level, somebody's just going to drive further down Evergreen or down Warren and go to the next one. Mm-hmm. No problem. Mm-hmm. Big business doesn't sort of suffer from the same burden to compete for your business. And that's really central to this story. Over the last couple of decades, 3/4 of American industries, large industries, are more concentrated today than they were a couple of decades ago. Mm-hmm. They're dominated by fewer players than they were a few decades ago. This is everything from shipping to banks, grocery retail, to meat packing. I mean, all of these industries are consolidated. So what does that fundamentally mean? There was once an era in this country where large corporations had to compete for your business, had to innovate, had to invent new things, had to hustle, had to market better. They don't have to do that as much anymore. And so that just gives them free rein to raise prices. And this is what we call the company's pricing power. Their pricing power was really enhanced through this era of consolidation, of mergers, of companies getting bigger, stronger, with less competition. And that is the distinguishing factor, I think.
Yeah.
If I could add just one more factor,
yeah,
too. Large companies, unlike small businesses, have enormous computing power, access to sophisticated technologies that allow them, frankly, to surveil consumers, which is something I think we'll talk about today, that small businesses don't have. You know, the local tire repair shop doesn't know when you get paid. McDonald's might know that, though. Mm-hmm. If you use the McDonald's app, McDonald's could know when your payday is. And they could theoretically charge you more for a McFlurry the day you get paid, right, as opposed to the day before.
Yeah. This is the marriage, I guess, between big data,
yes,
and big business.
That's
right now.
That's exactly right.
And I do want to talk about that, yeah, in a little bit. What happens with this money that these corporations are charging. These big corporations, as you say, they raise their prices irrespective of cost and irrespective of the other inflationary forces that are working in the economy. And as you point out, they make more money in the post-pandemic period than they did in 70 years. How do we know that's all profit? And why doesn't it then recirculate in the economy? I think a CEO would say to you, well, yeah, we made that money, but I have employees now and I am buying more things from other companies. Why is it bad for business to make that money?
Yeah. Well, where did the money go? I mean, executive pay skyrocketed. Stock buybacks skyrocketed. This is basically the practice of, instead of using profits to invest in, you know, future ventures and sort of more production or some other productive capacity that could benefit workers and the economy more broadly, some companies simply buy back their own stock to inflate their stock prices and to make their
stock. You see that a lot.
You see that a lot. It really, actually, during this period that we're talking about, stock buybacks exceeded $1 trillion in 2021. That was an all-time high. So you have a situation where, just to establish the causal chain, you know, companies' input costs, what we call their input costs, they did go up during the pandemic. There's no denying that. But companies then raised their prices above and beyond what would be necessary to protect their margins and keep their margins the same. And so that is what we have been calling profiteering. And so they reap record profits as a result. The record profits go into buying back their own stock and paying out enormous dividends, of course. The labor share of income doesn't really go up that much. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now we're seeing wages sort of outpace inflation a little bit, mm-hmm. but certainly not commensurate with the rise, for example, in CEO pay, mm-hmm. and not keeping up with that on any level, even in terms of percentage growth.
You mean I'm not making as much as the chairman of GE?
Unfortunately, Stephen, you're not. But even relative to your own income, you're not. So it's not just sort of a in total terms. And so that's where the value. I'll tell you also, Stephen, where the money is not going. It's not going to taxes. That would actually be the way to distribute those.
Better throughout the economy.
Better through the exit. Sure. We have a system, you know, we have an age-old system of taking, you know, profits and making sure that they're distributed, you know, to the country, to infrastructure, to things that give us a functioning country, social supports, childcare. Of course, the largest companies in this country don't really pay taxes anymore.
They don't pay any taxes.
They don't pay any. A lot of them pay
at the federal level.
At the federal level, a lot of them don't pay very much in tax. This is largely due to the Trump tax reform in 2017. But of course, corporate taxation has been declining for quite some time. Yeah. And so, you know, I think taxing corporations would be a major, major disincentive to pursue some of these tactics that we're talking about and we'll continue to talk about.
Yeah. Anyone who's got to buy things right now is aware of how much they cost. But what is the overall effect of that on the economy from a kind of macro perspective?
Absolutely. Well, we at the Groundwork Collaborative, which is the organization I work for, we determined that in the second and third quarters of last year, corporate profits, you know, derived through a lot of these price hikes, accounted for 53% of all inflation. So 53% of all price growth in the economy
just went into people's pockets.
Corporate profits was causing that. There are other things that could lead to prices rising, such as the labor share, you know, but that's not what we saw. It's really corporate profits that's driving, that drove over half of inflation during that period. And so I think you do see some of these pricing tactics leading to inflation, but regardless of whether it affects, you know, one technical measure of inflation, like the consumer price index, it's just simply unfair, you know, to go to the grocery store. And I'm sure many of your viewers will relate to this. For those who had those, you know, those playground conspiracy theories, when you open a bag of Doritos, you know, are there less chips than there were? The answer is yes, actually. It's not a conspiracy.
Right. It's true. You're getting less for your money.
Yeah, you're getting less for your money. And so that is just one of the dizzying array of tactics that were deployed during the pandemic. That one is called shrinkflation.
Mm-hmm.
It's the idea of giving you less product, but charging you the same or a higher price.
Right.
And so that's real. It's simply unfair, regardless of what the macroeconomic indicator is. Another sort of manifestation of this, Stephen, if you and I both booked separate rooms for separate reasons, but we both booked a room in the Shinola Hotel right now, I don't want to sort of single out the Shinola Hotel. Mm-hmm. Just call it any hotel, a mm-hmm. Hyatt, somewhere in the United States. Same time, same city, next door. We could pay different prices for those hotel rooms. That also is just profoundly unfair.
Now, and the reason for that is?
The reason for that is because companies are building what is called, or have access to what is called, your identity graph.
Right.
This is basically...
This is back to the data.
They know your email, your social media activity, your travel history, your retail history, how long you spend on certain websites. This is surveillance. This is corporate surveillance. If the government were doing this on this scale, people would be outraged. This happens all the time in e-commerce. If you're booking that same hotel room, Stephen, on a Mac and I'm using a PC, you might be charged higher because the company determines that people with Macs have more money.
Right.
How they determine that? These are things we don't have access to, which, by the way, can lead to a lot of discrimination, mm-hmm. if you really think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say, just to give folks another example, let's say that a large retailer is charging you a price based on your zip code. Now, they're not explicitly saying that that means your race, but in America, that's what it is.
Yeah.
You know, if I can see that you spend most of your time in, using advanced geolocation, you spend most of your time in 48126, it's not too hard to figure out that you're probably Arab American.
Mm-hmm. You live in Dearborn.
Right. You live in 48213, you're probably black.
Mm-hmm.
And so, although there are laws outlawing, it's explicitly illegal to charge somebody a different price based on their race. Well, if you use location as a proxy, it's not hard to imagine where that can lead.
Yeah.
That was Bilal Baydoun. He is the director of policy and research at the Left-Leaning Groundwork Collaborative in Washington. Coming up next, we're going to revisit a conversation about how facial recognition technology collects information about us and how that info is being used. Back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I've got Carrie Jr. II with us. We want to turn now to a conversation we had about AI and facial recognition technology. And this is something we've talked about before on the show, but this time we had a conversation about the data that gets collected from this technology and what corporations and government are actually doing with that data.
And more specifically, and as it relates to the city of Detroit, law enforcement. So the Detroit Police Department uses facial recognition technology in their work. And in a recent report in the New York Times, Detroit Police Department is responsible for 3 of the 7 known instances when facial recognition technology has led to wrongful arrests. And that report was written by Kashmir Hill. She is a feature writer at the New York Times. She covers privacy, artificial intelligence, and surveillance. And she's the author of a book called Your Face Belongs to Us. And she joined us this week to discuss facial recognition technology and how it's being implemented.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to note, too, that following some recent lawsuits into the wrongful arrest in the city of Detroit, the police department here has issued some new guidelines on how they're going to use facial recognition technology going forward.
Yeah, I mean, they're trying to clean it up.
And even
the ACLU is giving them some credit.
Correct.
For the changes that they're making. At the same time, the fundamental question is about the use of this technology and whether it makes sense given all the privacy concerns,
right,
and the accuracy. And I think this conversation did a good job of kind of illuminating where the discussion about this bumps up against those limits. Okay, so I want to start here. Artificial intelligence is moving really fast through our culture and kind of all over our society. It's in entertainment, of course. People's work is affected by it. Academia is trying to figure out where AI kind of fits in college and in K-12. And of course, we're seeing it in policing as well. But you know, it's not new. And I guess I want to start with having you go back to a starting point. How has law enforcement been using AI? And when did this really make its way into the idea of policing these things?
Okay. So there's been interest from the police in using AI, you know, going back decades now. I specifically have been focused on the use of facial recognition technology, mm-hmm. which is something police started using in the early 2000s. But there are a lot of other tools that they use, such as predictive policing tools that are meant to tell you when crime is going to happen so you can send police to those areas. And that is, I mean, there's technological tools for doing that, but that's actually based on work that the NYPD started doing in the 1990s, where they would keep track of this on paper. They would say, okay, you know, we've seen this subway station have crime every day for, you know, 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should definitely, you know, put officers there. And so, you know, you have AI tools that are listening for gunshots, and they're supposed to let police know when they hear it so that they can send patrol cars there. There's lots of different types of AI, but there's also a lot of questions around how well those tools work.
Yeah. So I want to inject a pop culture reference that that I am quite fond of. So the 2002 film Minority Report, which is made by Steven Spielberg and stars Tom Cruise, I think is a really interesting rendering of policing in the future. Of course, it's the future rendered from 2002. So that's now, you know, almost two decades ago. But the use of facial recognition in that film, the use of data tools to recognize people and identify people is kind of, you know, because it's a film and it's Hollywood, it's an extreme, but in some ways now it doesn't seem all that extreme. I mean, there's parts of the movie that are still not possible now and might seem ridiculous, but so much of it, I guess, doesn't. And so talk about how quickly this has moved, and how much more effective, I guess, these tools are, at least from the vantage point of the police today than they were, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think Minority Report holds up in many ways.
Yeah.
In that case, you know, people were tracked by their irises.
Right.
And so Tom
not even
Cruise
your whole face, right?
Yeah, not your whole face. So Tom Cruise is able to evade detection by swapping out his eyeballs. It's a little harder if you're being searched by face. You can't really switch your face around too much. Yeah, I mean, the big thing that has changed in AI in the last decade is that AI has gotten more powerful and more accurate thanks to neural net technology. You know, we basically have gotten better at, or computers have gotten better at AI because they're able to digest so much data and look for patterns in it. So when police first started using facial recognition in the early 2000s, it really didn't work that well. you know, the computers struggle to be able to mm-hmm. recognize that two different photos of somebody were the same person if, you know, they had facial hair or if they were looking away from the camera or if the lighting was really different in two different photos. So it was pretty good at, you know, taking two mugshots and comparing them or even two driver's license photos. So DMVs would use it to make sure there wasn't a fraudster who was trying to create seven different identities for themselves. But it didn't work in other conditions. Like identifying somebody off a surveillance video, you didn't really have much of a chance of doing that. But, you know, the technology got more powerful. And I like to talk about facial recognition because it's such a specific example of AI. And it's kind of easy to wrap your head around.
Yeah, yeah. And talk about this neural net that you referenced. I'm not sure most people even know what that is or what it means.
Yeah, we call it neural network technology because it's supposed to work similar to the human brain in that you have, you know, different neurons with different tasks. And essentially, the easy way to think of it is just really advanced pattern recognition. You give a computer a whole bunch of information, a whole bunch of data, and it learns the best way to process it. So with face recognition, for example, computer scientists at Facebook were able to give computers thousands and thousands of photos in which people had tagged themselves. So, you know, 2,000 different photos of a person on the beach, at a wedding, you know, at a dim bar, looking away from the camera, looking up, you know, wearing lots of different clothes, having different hairstyles. And the computer is able to look at those thousands of photos and figure out what information it needs about a face to recognize that person in all those different conditions. So thanks to kind of the explosion of photos, computers getting more powerful and being able to digest a lot of data, computers were able to more easily recognize human faces. And they're now probably better at facial recognition than humans are under the right circumstances. And that is why we have these tools today like ChatGPT that seem so, so powerful, that seem intelligent, because computers, like with faces, they've gotten really good at analyzing words and patterns of words, and they're able to predict quite powerfully, you know, what words should follow what other words.
I mean, you said something there that's really key, that that facial recognition is probably better at discerning who somebody is than the human brain is. In other words, that our minds and our eyes are not quite as trained, perhaps, as these computers are. But at the same time, that's a little scary, right? Should we be comfortable with that?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how it's getting used. I love being able to open my iPhone with my face.
Right? The iPhone knows your face, right?
I like that it's faster going through the airport now and entering another country because I can just, you know, put my passport down on a scanner, look into a camera, and face recognition search is made to see if, you know, my biometric face print matches the one on the chip in my passport. I like those conveniences, but it is scary to think of how face recognition is getting deployed in some places. You know, in Russia and China, they have face recognition running on their cameras in public spaces that you can track somebody, you can find somebody. Mm. Very useful for if you have, you know, a missing child and you're trying to find out where that person is, but it can also be used to identify protesters and punish them if the state doesn't like what they're protesting. Here in New York City, where I am right now, Madison Square Garden, an events venue, started using facial recognition technology to identify lawyers that worked at law firms that had sued it, so it could keep them from coming to Knicks games and Rangers games and Mariah Carey concerts because the owner of Madison Square Garden just didn't like these lawyers. It was causing a lot of trouble for them. And so he said, you can't come in, you know, unless you drop your suits against us. So this can really be a tool that can be wielded to track us, to potentially punish us. There's a lot. It like with so many technologies, the question of whether it's good or bad is really in how it is deployed.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, the looming question behind all of this is the data that's associated with it, right? So I walk around and walk in front of cameras that take my picture, or I put pictures of myself on social media or elsewhere on the internet, and that all gets collected somewhere. And it doesn't get collected in isolation. It gets collected in connection to all of the other things that that are publicly available or that I've made available about myself. And so this idea of the storage and use of that data, of not just your image and your likeness, but how that image and likeness connects to other information about you, is the thing that that I think we all are most concerned with as this technology develops.
Yeah, I don't think that most of us, when we were using the internet, you know, over the last 20 plus years or 5 plus years, depending on what your age is, we're realizing that every single image that we posted publicly to the internet might one day be associated with us. And that is what's happened, because we've had companies come along like Clearview AI. There's a couple of other ones that they've scraped the internet of as many photos as they can find. Clearview says it has 40 billion photos, and they have subjected them to a biometric search. And so, you know, if your photo gets uploaded, it will show everywhere on the internet where your face appears. And so that might reveal your name, your social media profiles, and also maybe photos that you posted to the internet that are not affiliated with your name, or photos that other people have posted you mm-hmm. on the internet. And so it basically reorganizes the internet around our faces in a way that none of us saw coming. And I think for some people, depending on what you have out there, could be, you know, alarming. And also, you know, it for somebody who has that tool, it means the end of anonymity. I mean, they can find out anyone's identity if they have any kind of public presence on the internet.
I do think there is culturally, I guess, a hurdle about the way in which all this has happened, that the expectation that so many people have is that there is still some sphere of personal privacy around your images and info about you. And the truth is that that doesn't exist in the way that we imagine, that this rapid advance of technology and our, you know, passive consent almost to using it has eroded that sphere in a way that I'm not sure any of us would have not just predicted, but maybe even agreed to.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to be outraged by this. And it's not just a matter of cultural expectations. It's about legal expectations. And for most of the U.S., we have pretty weak privacy laws. In Europe and other countries with stronger privacy laws that say you do need permission from somebody to use their personal information, Clearview AI has been declared illegal, that what they did was illegal. Places like France and Germany and Canada and Australia said, yeah, you need people's permission to put their faces into a biometric database.
Express permission.
Express consent, yeah. And they, you know, they said Clearview couldn't do business there, and they fined them. It is very American. And there are, within the United States, some states that have some rules around this. One of them is Illinois. For people that live in Illinois, they have a law that says you can't use somebody's voice print or fingerprints or face print without their permission if you're a company, or face fines. And so, you know, we are in a moment where technology has made things possible that weren't contemplated by a lot of the people that were making the laws. And I would say in most places, you know, the law hasn't caught up with the technology. And I'm not sure that the law really matches what people's cultural, you know, societal expectations are. And that's why we're having this huge debate about AI in our society right now. There are things that are technologically possible that maybe as a society, we don't want people to be doing.
That was our conversation about AI and facial recognition technology and what companies and authorities are doing with all the data. And that's the end of our recap show.
And I thought they were all really insightful. I am curious to see what other avenues of our life include data collection, but broadly.
The short answer is all
everywhere. Everywhere. That's fair.
That's it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.